coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Our fifth annual summer reading list.
And I'm sitting there and I'm eating and I'm reading a book, right? I'm alone. I don't know anybody. I'm eating and I'm reading a book. Fine, right? Waitress comes over to me. What you reading for? I said, wow, I've never been asked that. God dang it, you stumped me.
Fiction.
Nonfiction.
Philosophical titles.
Then this trucker in the next booth gets up, stands over me and goes, well, looks like we got ourselves a reader. Am I stepping out of some intellectual closet here? There, I said it. I feel better.
What are you reading this summer?
Summer! Time, time, time. Child, living season.
It's our fifth annual summer reading list.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, it's our annual Summer Reading List show.
Ken, this is the fifth year we've asked our audience to help us compile a philosophical summer reading list. I've really been impressed over the years at how widely and deeply our listening audience thinks and reads. I mean, it's really made me happy to see that we've got a lot of avid readers out there. The book has been declared all but dead, but our readers haven't heard the news.
You know, the book as we knew it and reading as we knew it may be dead, John, but people still read. Maybe they don't read the printed page as much as they once did, but they read their Kindles, their iPads, even their clunky old computer screens. You can get just about any book you want in an instant these days. And you know, these newfangled devices may lead to a rebirth of reading, a rebirth of the book.
Well, you know, they have to go a long way to accomplish that. In 2007, one quarter of adult Americans didn't read a single book. On average, Americans read about 4 books per year. And that number keeps getting smaller year after year.
Well, okay, maybe book reading is on the decline. But people still read all kinds of writing that didn't even exist decades ago. The blog, the online chat, the text message. Reading lives, John. It just lives in different forms.
Oh, blogs and that kind of stuff. That so-called reading. That stands the genuine reading the way Velveeta stands the real cheese, Ken.
Well, you know, I had to say it, but you sound a little like a snob, John. And a little like a Luddite to boot.
Well, I'm neither of those things, Ken, but I am a lover of reading. Genuine, real reading. Reading of the deepest kind.
Okay, tell me what you mean by genuine reading of the deepest kind.
Well, it engages the capacities to think and feel. Think of reading a novel that moves you deeply. Not one that just kind of gives you a lot of pleasant images or titillating images, but one that really takes over your imagination, your moral imagination. It gives you problems to work out. Think of philosophy books that challenge you to think and think again. They don't just beat you over the head with some newfangled arguments or a bunch of symbols, but they lead you to new insights and new depths of thought. Or think of nonfiction that takes something you thought you knew all about and presents it in a whole new way. It's that kind of reading and that kind of writing that I just think may be on the decline.
You know, the kind of reading and writing you're talking about, John, critical, reflective reading that's emotionally and imaginatively engaged, it's both a fun thing and I believe it's a good thing, a morally good thing. I actually believe it can help make you a better person because it exercises capacities that play a huge role in improving your real life, capacities to judge, to feel, to imagine. And, you know, I like you. I would hate to see that go away. I would hate it.
Well, I guess as long as we're alive and our listeners are alive, it won't go away completely. But there's a lot that threatens it. The producers of mass culture, especially mass culture for the young, specialize in promoting the cultural equivalent of synthetic processed cheese food. If you feed people that sort of stuff enough, after a while, they begin to like it, and it begins to dominate the market.
Yeah, yeah, and that would be a really sad outcome. But, you know, I think that does help explain why the kind of reading that we've been talking about can seem to be something only for the elite few who spend their time buried in dusty old books rather than hooked up to these newfangled screens. Still, you know, I firmly believe that we need to empower everybody in our society, everybody to become the kind of readers we're talking about. I actually think it's the birthright of a citizen of a democracy to be empowered to read deeply, and that's definitely something our school should be doing more of.
Well, I couldn't agree more, Ken. I mean, like all of our candidates for governor, I think we should cut taxes and improve the schools, although I'm a little vague on how the two are connected. But to get back to your point, that's why it's important for us to do our little part here on Philosophy Talk by compiling a summer philosophical reading list.
Every summer, we want to invite our audience of very avid readers to help us extol the virtues and joys of reading, real reading, deep reading.
Become an ambassador for the book, folks.
Tell us what good reads are on your own summer reading list. What have you already read, or what do you plan to read that you would recommend to others out there?
You can join us. You can contribute to this endeavor by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Devin Strolovich, hits the streets to get a sense of what people are reading this summer. He files this report.
My name is Jeff. I'm a musician. I enjoy reading in the summer too clever for its own good postmodern contemporary American fiction because it's fun. Like revisiting Tom Robbins or like reading like one of the Jonathans, like Jonathan Franzen. I'm reading The Corrections right now, even though I shouldn't be.
My name is Tamara Kamatovich, and I'm reading The Castle, Kafka. I actually study German literature, but I don't actually have time to read the bigger novels. In the summer, I have an opportunity to read a book without worrying too much about analyzing it, and I kind of had planned to read, like, criminal novels this summer, and I haven't gotten to it yet.
Julius. During the summer, I plan on reading Dan Brown's new book. Just something that's not very educational and wouldn't have to use my brain that much.
My name's David. I'm a traveler, and I'm currently reading The Savage Detectives by Robert Bolano. It's about, like, these poets traveling around Mexico and South America and Europe. I kind of like tales, like mythic tales in the summer, you know, when you come to the park and read and relax.
Hi, my name's Liz. I'm reading The Lovely Bones. I'm a nurse, and I bought this book for $1 in Australia for the plane ride home, and it's the best dollar I've ever spent, I think.
Okay, hi, my name is Erin. I'm from Australia. I'm reading The Source by, I think it's James Michigan or something. It's a really intense book, and the copy I have is like from the 1950s, so it's like really, really, really small writing in yellow pages, and it's really, really thick, and it's, I feel like, I don't know, I normally speed read, so I feel like I have to have lots of breaks for my brain from it.
My name is Tony Ferrari, originally from Cincinnati, Ohio. I'm a chef by trade. I'm currently reading Fork It Over, which is a book about a man that travels the world and eats his way through different cities full of great restaurants.
My name's Gretchen, and I work at a kitchen at a bar, and I'm currently reading Mouse, the graphic novel about the Holocaust. There's a couple of them. I've been meaning to read them for years, and they're on my girlfriend's bookshelf, so I stole them today.
First name's Tommy. I'm a load supervisor for UPS. Of course, I had to read The Golden Compass. After seeing the movie, I was like, you know, I heard the book so much better, and it turned out the book was so much better than the movie.
My name is Pam. Not currently reading any books at the moment, but I've had sitting next to my bed The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Heard a lot of good things about it. The movie just came out, so thinking about reading that.
I'm Becca, and I'm reading The Girl Who Played with Fire, which is the follow-up to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which I did not read, but I heard was great.
I'm in grad school. I am in my last semester, so all I do is my thesis. But during my break on my thesis right now, I came across a book today called Signals in the Free Pile at one of the books. I rarely get to read anything besides psychology books, and I guess this technically still is one. I've been in school for so long, I only read books for school, and even those I don't get to finish.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Devin Strolovich.
Special thanks to Patrick Coleman for that report. I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And today it's our fifth annual summer reading list, and we're dying to know what you plan to read this summer, what you would recommend that others read this summer. Join our conversation. Give us your contribution. Become an ambassador for the book by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. We're also monitoring our email, so send us an email at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we've opened up a blog about the pleasures of summer reading. So, John, why don't we start out, since you and I are the philosophy experts, the resident philosophy experts, why don't we start out by talking about some books of philosophy that might make good summer reading? And anything you yourself are looking forward to digging into this this summer, or anything you would recommend to others that they dig into?
Well, lately I've been actually digging into a book by a friend of mine named Jack Bowen, who teaches philosophy around here, mostly to high schoolers. It's called If You Can Read This, The Philosophy of Bumper Stickers.
The Philosophy of Bumper Sticker. Now, that sounds maybe like summer reading because bumper stickers are light fare, but is there anything philosophically interesting about Jack's book?
Yeah, he takes bumper stickers, and they lead to little meditations. It's a bit like, you know, reading Wittgenstein or Lichtenberg. I don't want to pump up Jack Bowen too much. But it's pretty thoughtful stuff. I mean,
give me an example. Come on.
Well, you take This Is Not a Bumper Sticker. That's a bumper sticker you may have seen. That leads to a good discussion of paradoxes. Why Won't God Heal Amputees? You may have seen that one. It leads to a good discussion of the problem of evil. My child was the student of the month at Jordan Junior High School. We see that kind of bumper sticker all the time, and that leads Jack into a discussion of elitism and all sorts of interesting
topics.
It
sounds like a fun book, you know, because there was some philosophers in the past have had this aphoristic style of writing, and it sounds like Jack takes little aphorism and does some philosophical reflection on these aphorisms.
Yeah, he lets the bumpers supply the aphorisms, and he supplies the commentary. Now I know you're reading something by our friend across the bay, John Searle. What's his most recent book?
Yeah, his most recent book is called Making the Social World, The Structure of Human Civilization. This is actually an interesting thing because I actually started digging into this book in preparation for a show that we recorded with Searle at the Mars Theater that's going to air sometime later this year. And I'm writing a book myself about normativity and meaning and how social life is constituted. And Searle actually, it turns out, has some fascinating ideas about this stuff. And on some things, he struck me. And so I've figured I've got to dig into this work. It's really fascinating stuff. I think this is one of the most important philosophical questions that's been understudied by philosophers. Where does social life and social things and social meaning come from? How does, you know, the nature is just a bunch of matter and stuff, but human beings are deeply social creatures. So I'm really fascinated by Searle's work on this. It's kind of foundational, and he's a good writer. You know?
Well, so just to make it clear that we're not only reading stuff from across the bay, I'm planning to read a new book by Jack Rakoff, our Pulitzer Prize-winning political scientist and historian at Stanford. He wrote a book, Original Meetings, about 10 years ago that won the Pulitzer Prize, and he's got a new book called Revolutionaries, A New History of the Invention of America, that I'm sure will be philosophically very rich as well as historically fascinating.
So here's another one that crosses boundaries, disciplinary boundaries, that I've already started reading it. Again, I started reading a lot of things in preparation for work or for this show or stuff, or just for pleasure. But one book I started and didn't finish and want to finish this summer is Alison Gopnik's really fine book. It's called The Philosophical Baby: What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. Now, Allison's a psychologist, but she's a deeply philosophical psychologist, and she's a really fine writer. That book is such a good read. I've read about a third of it, and I've got the rest of it on my tap for reading this summer. And if you haven't read that book, and you're a parent, and you're interested in truth, love, and the meaning of life, read that book, because it's a really great read, a really fine read.
Yeah, it's on my list, too. An older book, by the way, if you're interested in the whole revolutionary kind of stuff and the founding fathers, that I read just a little while ago and really liked. It's a short book, Joseph J. Ellis, The Founding Fathers, The Revolutionary Generation. It tells you how these people actually felt about each other, and it's kind of interesting. You know, we all know that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson didn't get along for a while, and Aaron Burr shot Alexander Hamilton, but there's a lot of other interesting stuff too.
Yeah, so look, those are some of our suggestions, more from our philosophical point of view, and we love to hear your suggestions, right? You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're putting together our fifth annual summer reading list.
We'd love to have your help. What will you read this summer? What have you already read that you'd recommend to others? After the break, we'll start with fiction and we'll get suggestions from a novelist who recently joined us on the program, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. You can join us by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
Philosophical fiction plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
One day I read a book, I can't remember when, but one of these days I'm going to do it again, yes sir. One of these days I'm going to do it again.
It's the summer reading list edition of Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and we want your help. We want you to become ambassadors for the books. What are the most amazing philosophical reads you've ever experienced? What works of fiction are you dying to read again? If you were going to read only one philosophically rich book this summer, what would it be? Share your thoughts about great philosophically oriented fiction.
The number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And you can share your thoughts with the world by posting to our blog at theblog.philosophytalk.org.
We're joined now by Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. She's a prolific writer herself of philosophical fiction and a great philosopher. She's author most recently of 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a work of fiction. Rebecca, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, good to be back.
Rebecca, your book should be on everybody's summer philosophical reading list if they haven't already read it. It's a paradigm. It's the main part of the book is people that are involved in philosophically rich problems. And then there's appendix, which is pretty pure philosophy, 36 arguments for the existence of God and pretty much what's wrong with them.
So we want to put your book right there on the top of everybody's summer reading list, Rebecca. Okay. But let me make a comment. Like John and me, I'm sure you do at least two kinds of reading. Reading that you do in service of your philosophical and literary projects, and reading that you do for pure pleasure and enlightenment. And tell us about how the two parts of your own reading life relate.
You know, the boundaries really blur because I'm very self-indulgent and I only pick projects where the reading is just going to be sheer pleasure. And
oh,
I usually
man.
Overdo it. You know, I do too much reading because it's not writing. It's so much more fun to read. So it blurs. But, of course, you know, I do have the books that just have caught my fancy and seem to have nothing to do with the writing.
Well, you're lucky to be able to choose your projects in that way. You know, that's really cool. But help our listeners think about what they might read this summer based on either both sides of your own reading life and your vast reading and writing experience. What would you recommend to people out there?
What would I recommend? Well, right now I am reading avidly a book that probably lots of people have already read, A.S. Byatt's Possession. I don't know why it took me so long to get around to it.
I haven't gotten around to that. Tell us about that book.
Well, it's a kind of mystery story. It's extraordinarily rich and intense and erudite. I'm so blown away by it. But the plot line has to do with two timelines, and it's two contemporary researchers on two Victorian poets and who stumble on a clue that they might have had, these two Victorian poets may have had an affair, and then it's back to the Victorian poets themselves, and it's just very, very rich and absorbing.
Is it is it philosophical rich? This is a novel, right?
It is a novel.
Is it philosophically rich? You write philosophically rich novel. Is it, you know, rich like one of your novels is rich?
Well, you know, I could turn it into a philosophical, put a philosophical spin on it. You know, sort of the nature of discovery and the intuitive and emotional components of knowledge. I guess I could put a kind of...
So it's kind of raw material for philosophical thinking, but maybe not quite as explicit.
Yes, not as explicit. Now, one of the novels that I've never read, one of the classic novels, and when I was talking about my own book, people said, have you ever read Samuel Butler's The Way of All Flesh? Mm-hmm. And said that there was a large overlap between my themes and his. And that's one of those, you know, classic novels that I never read. And so I plan to read it this summer. Last summer, my husband and I read Moby Dick together.
Oh, that's a great book. You read it aloud?
We did it aloud.
Even the passages about whaling and all that?
Exactly. So we alternated chapters. It was was the most wonderful experience. And, you know, because then after each chapter, we would, you know, we would discuss it. And
yeah.
It was such a, I'm blown away by that. And I want to talk him into doing that this summer for The Way of All Flesh. Have have you read that?
No, I haven't. Have you read The Way of All Flesh?
Many years ago, and I remember it was a very good book. And I also remember the paperback edition of it I had extraordinarily small print, and I've never recovered.
Oh, dear.
So, Rebecca, I'd love to talk. We got to get you back on Philosophy Talk because I'd love to talk to you some more. I'd love to talk to you about.
Well, she better finish another book.
Yeah, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're compiling our 5th annual summer reading list, and we'd love to hear from you. Join us. Contribute to this discussion by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Or finally, leave thoughts on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. And we've got Phyllis from Berkeley on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Phyllis.
Thank you.
So what's on your mind?
Well, the book by Robert Harris called Imperium, a novel of ancient Rome. Harris is the author or scriptwriter of the film The Ghost Rider. He addresses issues of power, both in terms of Tony Blair's behavior and earlier historical topics. This study of the Imperium is the study of the life of Cicero, and Harris read every word that Cicero recorded, and he used this to create a page-turner, which I recommend very, very highly.
Oh, wow. So you've read this.
I am reading it currently. I previously read his book, Pompeii, which is also
right. fabulous. Oh, that sounds like a great read. Do you know this novel, John?
No, I don't. Although I did see the movie Ghost Rider, I thought that was terrific.
So, what was the title again? Just a reminder.
The book on Cicero is called Imperium, a novel of ancient Rome.
Yeah, and it's very intriguing. Is it very philosophical?
Yes, because he's looking at power. How do people pull the levers? How do they behave?
Oh, yeah.
And he writes, it's just fascinating.
Oh, so Phyllis, thank you so much for the suggestion.
Well, thank you for your wonderful show.
Okay, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. We got Evie in Berkeley. Is that right? Evie, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks.
Is it Evie or Evie?
It's Evie.
Okay, Evie in Berkeley.
I decided that this summer I would work my way through the collected works of William Faulkner. And
so far,
Red Light in August, and, I mean, talk about dealing with good and evil, that's certainly a theme, and how characters under all kinds of intense pressure make moral choices. It's also fascinating, I think, because the books are often racist, and you also, as a reader, then are mulling ideas about good and evil and how can this guy write such a brilliant book.
When you say the books are racist, do you think Faulkner was a racist? Characters in his book are racist? Certainly characters in his book are racist. Do you think he was a racist?
Well, I think when you can... let me put it this way. I think that he was able to look critically at his culture, right, which was the white, southern... Mississippi culture, and I think that he was a man of that culture at the same time. What I will say, and I think that he, sometimes the narrators of the books, who are third person, say sort of negative things, negative generalizations about African Americans.
Oh, definitely.
But I also do feel that the African American characters are often very round.
Right.
And in that way, it's very compelling to me.
Okay.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I do see what you mean. I do see what you mean. I am a big admirer of Faulkner, even though I'm not a big admirer of the South in which he was formed. You know. But thanks so much for the contribution, Abby.
Absolutely. Take care.
Okay, John, you got an email there you want to talk about?
Well, we have lots of email, and we won't get through all of it at all, but it'll all be up on our website, and it's still coming in. John Comley points out that Melville, who we just talked about, said every day he read the Bible, some Shakespeare, and Dante. So that's something you might want to try, read the Divine Comedy. And then we had a very interesting suggestion just came in, at least it appealed to me. Christine Ellis says that she has just finished Your Inner Fish by Neil Shubin. It's about the evolution of the human body and shows how we are basically just jerry-rigged fish. I mean, I feel that way about myself. I wasn't sure anybody else felt that way. I said, maybe not philosophical on the surface, but it can make you think deeply about who you are and why.
You know, I like that thing. I always think Shakespeare's line in The Tempest should be, instead of we are such stuff as dreams are made of, we are such stuff as yeast is made of. But, you know, we've got lots of callers on the line, 1-800-525-9917. And we got Leslie in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Leslie.
Hi there. Good morning.
Yeah, what's your comment? What's your addition?
My comment is I would like to recommend a French book by Muriel Barbery, and it's called The Elegance of the Hedgehog. It's very popular now. It is really very philosophical, not necessarily easy to begin, but very rich once you're into it, rather unforgettable. Excellent for summer reading.
It's translated into English, I assume.
Yes, it's translated into English.
Well, give us a sense of how that title relates to the content of the book.
Well, it's a very strange title, which prompts people to study what the hedgehog is, because we don't really have them around here. They're prevalent in Western Europe. A small creature on the surface, perhaps not pretty, full of spines, about the size of a guinea pig, but a very elegant little creature able to protect itself, roll up in a little spiny ball if feeling threatened. Excellent for the garden, by the way. If you have some hedgehogs in your garden, they eat slugs, they eat snails, they protect your garden.
Is the book really about the lives of hedgehogs, or is it about
No, it's not. In fact, there is nothing about hedgehogs in it except the title, so you know you have to kind of do a little study on why the author chose that, which is interesting in itself. The book is about French families in an apartment house in contemporary Paris, and how they relate to each other, and how they suffer in silence, and how they manage to get together as soulmates.
This sounds like an intriguing book, and maybe I'm going to pick it up. You know, you've intrigued me with your description of it, so I'm going to thank you for the contribution, Leslie.
Thank you, and thank you for your show.
Oh, okay. You're very welcome.
We're joined now by another past guest. That's Alexander Nehemas. He's a professor of philosophy from Princeton University. He's author most recently of Only a Promise of Happiness, The Place of Beauty in a World of Art. Alexander, welcome back to Philosophy Talk. It's been a long time, dude.
I'm very happy to be back. Thank you for having me, and I hope we can meet again. Or on the waves.
Well, Alexander, I mean, you're really into beauty, as the titles of your most recent book suggest.
Except he doesn't like trees. I remember that.
Yeah, he doesn't like trees. From trees, there's other beautiful things. I take it you read only really beautiful books. Do you have any beautiful books you want to tell us about?
Well, I don't know about beauty, guys, but I certainly am reading something and will be reading something that's going to take a lot of work this summer, and that's Spinoza's Ethics.
Wow. Oh, dear.
Jeepers. You're going to take that to the beach?
Well, no. I have other books for the beach. I mean, I believe that relationships with books are like relationships with friends. You have friends that you make for life, and that you have acquaintances, and you have everything in between.
So is Spinoza a book that you've read a lot before and you're going to reread it? Or
it's the first book, the first philosophy book I ever read. Mm. I didn't understand a word of it, and I decided anything that was so incomprehensible had to be important. I'm not sure that's a good reason to go into philosophy, but that's what made me do it.
So, I mean, what is it about Spinoza that grips your mind? I mean, Spinoza, for those of our listening audience who haven't picked up for Spinoza, that's a forbidding read, wouldn't you say, Alexander?
It's extremely hard, but it's really worth the trouble. Spinoza, the book is called Ethics, and it is structured as if it were a book of geometry.
Mm-hmm.
It has axioms, it has definitions, it has axioms, it has theorems, which he proves from the axioms, the definitions, and earlier theorems.
And it takes him forever to get to the part that justifies the title Ethics. It's all this stuff about substance and necessity. And
I'm not sure I've ever made it that far myself, to tell you the truth.
Well, frankly, I prefer the later parts, because the first parts are even more difficult. But he has an amazing view of the world, Spinoza. I mean, he is a complete determinist. He thinks we have nothing like free will as we generally understand it. He thinks there is, again, no responsibility the way we traditionally understand it, and yet he is perfectly happy in the world. And I want to understand the mind that can have both these attitudes at the same time. I'm thinking about issues that have to do with friendship and how friends influence one another. And in order to do that, I need to understand a bit better how we act, what human action is. And I think Spinoza has a lot to tell us about it.
Okay, now suppose some of our listeners are going to lug their Spinoza to the beach or to the lawn chair. They probably want to take something helpful to read along with it. I don't know, Stuart Hampshire had a nice book on Spinoza years ago. Is there something more recent that's a good introduction to Spinoza, a good help for the person who's slugging through the ethics?
I still think Hampshire's book is probably the best straightforward introduction to Spinoza. It places him in context. It talks about all his various ideas and approaches. In fact, Rebecca Goldstein, your earlier guest tonight, has actually written about Spinoza as well, and that's another book that people might want to take a look at.
Good point.
I want to ask you another general philosophical questions about hard reads, right?
Yeah.
I teach students writing, and I say, good writing is hard work, but it shouldn't be hard reading. Right.
Right.
When is a hard read worth it? What makes a hard read worth it?
I think that's a really good question. A hard read is worth it when, after you've sort of metaphorically sweated your way through it, you think that something about what you think, what you know, what you feel, what you want, is not what it was before, and that it's in that way, in a way that makes a difference, actually. I mean, you know, we always change everything all the time about ourselves, but if you can feel that something about your orientation to the world, even if it's not, you know, about the whole attitude, but something that makes a difference to you has changed,
yeah,
then the read has been worth it.
I think I agree with you, and I think the power of reading to transform who and what you are,
exactly,
not just what you know, what you feel, but how you imagine the world and all that, I think that's the thing that we lose in this Velveeta-izing of writing. Do you agree?
I think that's absolutely right. Reading is, as I said, it's not unlike a friendship, and having a friendship or starting a friendship is going to change you. It's going to change you seriously. The more important the friendship, the more you'll change. And I think that's what books are really like, and that's a big part of why they matter to us.
So, Alexander, we got to get you back on Philosophy Dog. It's been too long, and then we don't want you to be like an acquaintance. We want you to be like an old friend that we revisit and revisit.
Yeah,
an old friend. That's why we can always talk immediately and pick up where we were the last time we left off.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Alexander.
You're listening.
All the best to you, too.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're compiling our 5th annual summer reading list.
In our next segment, we're going to take on the issue of philosophically interesting works of nonfiction, and we'll be joined by another recent guest, San Francisco's very own Marilyn Yalom. You can contribute by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Nonfiction, and that's the truth, the absolute truth, plus more of your calls at 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917, and emails at comments@philosophytalk.org when Philosophy Talk continues.
For 5 or 6 hours in the month of July, the summer I read a collect.
It's our annual summer reading show. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. We rely on your intelligence. I'm Kent Taylor. Our phone lines are open. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Ken, we're joined now by Marilyn Yalom. She's the author of A History of the Wife, A History of the Breast, and most recently, The American Resting Place, 400 Years of History Through Our Cemeteries and Burial Grounds. Marilyn, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Glad to be here.
So, Marilyn, I've read a number of your books, and they're often wide-ranging. You know all kinds of stuff. So I imagine you must be, I know you must be, a really wide-ranging reader. So from your vast array of reading experience, what would you put on our listeners' summer reading list?
Well, I was going to start out with two that have already been mentioned, The Elegance of the Hedgehog and Goldstein's 36 Arguments for the Existence of God.
Tell me a little bit more about The Elegance of the Hedgehog, because I was a little puzzled by our caller's description. Tell me a little bit more about that.
It's a book that really took off in France because it has its finger on the pulse of French society, particularly the role of the concierge, the person who sits downstairs in upper-class apartments and takes the measure of the people who come and go. This one is of interest to people with philosophical passions, because the concierge, although her surface is that of a non-entity, is a devoted, hidden reader of philosophy, and that goes from writers such as Husserl to Marx and company. And she reads in private because she doesn't want to disturb the mask of being a concierge for the people who come and go outside of her room.
Now, you've really convinced me I need to read this book. John, you want to make a comment?
Well, just that there's a famous essay by Isaiah Berlin. I think it's called The Fox and the Hedgehog.
Fox and the Hedgehog.
Could one put together?
The title comes from. The hedgehog is the person who knows only one thing and knows it in depth, whereas the fox, according to Isaiah Berlin, knows all sorts of things. So this woman sees herself as a hedgehog, and she digs into her little, she burrows into her concierge's lodge, so to speak, and reads. She also listens to music.
So
the person in the book who's her counterpart, but at a very different level, is a 13-year-old girl, bourgeois girl, who lives in the apartment and who is also a lot smarter than the people around her. And she, this girl, has decided that a life is not worth living, and that if she doesn't find a reason for living within the next year, she's going to burn the building down and kill herself.
Wow.
So she's so there are questions here about the meaning of life and death.
Marilyn, you've really made me want to read this book. This sounds like a really fascinating book. And one of the things that, in passing, it's also about the transformative power of the act of reading, it sounds like. So I really want to read this book. Tell me, you've got other thoughts. You said you're going to start out with those two, and they were already mentioned.
Let me toss in another book by the same author, Muriel Barbery. It's called Gourmet Rhapsody. It's not anywhere near as complex or as philosophical as The Hedgehog, but it's a marvelous book for anybody interested in food and descriptions of food and all of the meaning of food for the author, and particularly the rather unpleasant narrator. And now that I'm on the subject of food, because, you know, food has a whole philosophy and ethos around it, there's a book I'm going to read this summer, which is Cakewalk by Kate Moses, which is her memoir of growing up in a dysfunctional family and finding baking and sweets as an outlet for her and a kind of therapy. So
there's a food theme running through some of your reading. I mean, I think food is a philosophically interesting and understudied thing. You know, the production of food in our world, the meaning of meals, the social function of food, the way we consume food is changing radically. I think there's room for deep philosophical reflection on, even if these books aren't that philosophical. I think
these books have depth, and that's why I could put them on the list.
So, Marilyn, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for being our past guest on Philosophy Talk. We have to get you, and I think you and Irvin are the only two husband-wife pair we've had, and you're a great pair. So
thanks so much.
So you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're compiling our 5th annual summer reading list. We'd love to have your suggestions. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And Mary in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mary.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking my call. My book suggestion for reading this summer is The Road by Cormac McCarthy. And it is very much reminds me of the sort of the myth of Sisyphus and Albert Camus. It's a post-apocalyptic story of characters called the man and the boy. And they trudge along the road, and it's very, very kind of depressing novel, but it has its own...
Just what you want this summer, depressing novel.
It's redemptive in the love that is between the boy and the man.
I see.
And in a world that often is very depressing and difficult, I think that this novel offers itself as a way to see it in a different way.
So when you say it's depressing, you mean it takes us into the existential crisis that any human being faces, you know, who am I, what am I, but it helps us find a way out. I don't think that's depression. I think that's empowering and honest and courageous.
But yes, it brings us to those existential
moments where you know, you have these terrible choices to make. You see these horrible things that happen in the world, and yet you still trudge forward. You still go on. You still push the rock up the hill, even though you know it's going to roll down again, and you just keep on doing it and keep on doing it, and because the love and it is in the actual work of pushing it up the hill.
So this is
I would recommend that.
That's a novel, also, right? And who was the author? Remind me.
Cormac McCarthy.
Uh-huh. Okay. And it's called The Road.
Reading, The Road. And it was a movie. I haven't seen the movie because some of the parts of the book are a little grim, and I didn't want to see them in the film. And I'm also reading the Border Trilogy that you may have heard of. It has All the Pretty Horses, The Crossing, and Cities of the Plain. One of my favorite authors. And The Tao Te Ching again.
Okay.
Well, thanks, Mary. I like Cormac McCarthy, so maybe I'll give The Road a read, although I have heard it's depressing. I've shied away from it. We've got quite a few emails. Like I said, we don't have time to go through them all, but they're all beyond the website. There's just an amazing number of really good suggestions, old books, new books. Now here's a recent email that suggests a book I meant to mention, which is Thomas Nagel's Secular Philosophy and the Religious Temperament. I mean, Nagel, as people know, is one of the best combinations of analytical philosophers and good writers that we have nowadays, and he's written a new book. This writer recommends Carl Sagan's Varieties of Scientific Experience, which I haven't read, and Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, which is always something to cheer you up after you've read Cormac McCarthy's The Road.
The Varieties of Scientific Experience, that's a play on James's The Varieties of Religious Experience, right?
Which isn't a bad read itself.
I
read that this year. And we've got everything that's come in from The Consolations of Philosophy to Miranda Fricker's Epistemic Injustice. That sounds great. Ray Langton's Sexual Solipsism. We had her on the show. The Meta Revolution by Grant Barkley. Have no ideas what that is.
That's a complicated one. I don't quite know how to describe it. But Ray Langton's Sexual Solipsism, that's a really, we had her on the show. She's a very powerful philosopher writing about pornography and all that. And it's a very deep and probing philosophical exploration of issues about pornography. It wasn't out when we were when we had interviewed her. It was forthcoming. So if it's coming out, that's great. And I highly recommend that. I second that recommendation. We've got another caller on the line, Dave in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dave.
Thank you. I'd like to recommend a nonfiction book, The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine by Michael Lewis.
Tell us about The Big Short.
Well, the subject is the economic crash of the last couple of years based on derivatives derived from from mortgage loans. And the interesting philosophical point is his description of the defense that they offer for themselves by the guys in brokerage houses who sold these investments at the same time their brokerage house was shorting the same investment.
So what is
the interesting defenses they went through to say this was legitimate, this was okay?
Give me a taste. Give us a taste.
Well, they were telling their customers, their suckers, that these were great investments and they should buy them. At the same time, they were shorting the same investment. They were betting it would go down. So they're telling their customers it's going to go up while their company is betting it's going to go down, and they defend this as being ethical. I think it's just unethical in the extreme unless you think your company is wrong.
Yeah, well, it certainly sounds unethical in the extreme. But it does, so I'm wondering if they had anything to say for themselves. Look, I do think the current economic crisis invites deep reflection on what a democratically sustainable mode of economic organization and economic life should be like. And I don't think the one we've just sort of gotten out of is all that deeply philosophically defensible. And the Republicans, you say, let them do whatever they want. That's obviously crazy. But, you know, should we be socialist? Should we? I think these times call for deep philosophical reflection about the proper organization of economic life. Does this book help with that?
It does and it doesn't. I myself am a libertarian, and I believe that what went wrong was that, with a very few exceptions documented in this book, nobody in the industry took a good look at the underlying investments and said, hey, this is crazy, you know, this is headed for disaster. And nobody got press for saying that. And There were people. There were a dozen smart, eloquent people who said, this is awful, but you didn't find it in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times.
There's all this new work in so-called behavioral economics that show how bad not just individuals are, but corporations are at assessing risk and reward. And all these people were blind to risk and all the reasons why they were blind to risk. And that's some disturbing stuff. You look like you want to make a last comment there.
Oh, just that I was teaching a seminar on metaphor the other day, and somebody came up with a metaphor that they had read, which was Goldman Sachs is a vampire squid perched on the face of humanity, burrowing its bloodsucker into any pool of wealth it finds. Now, I don't myself agree with that, but I do think it shows that our current economic crisis is making a contribution to literature, too.
Well, there you go. Dave, I want to thank you for joining us. That was a very interesting contribution. So, folks, we'll put all these contributions up on our website. You know, there's a huge number of emails and callers we didn't get to and entries on our blog, and we'll compile them all into a list for your reading pleasure with some comment from us. So thank you for all your contributions. This conversation continues. It continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. And we've also got this very, very lively Facebook page, Don, and it's just all kinds of stuff happens there, right? And I just wonder, you got one last thought before we say goodbye to these folks?
Well, I've been thinking about that math I put forward earlier, and if one out of four Americans has never read a book, and there's 350 million Americans, then there's at least there's at least 80 million Americans that haven't read a book. And it just occurred to me, I wrote that book.
Yeah, right. I think there are hundreds of millions of Americans who haven't read that book, John. That's a different question. But as I said, this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org.
And now for the final word, we turn to the paperback edition of our show, Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, every summer what remains of mainstream media assembles a small army of feature writers to compile summer reading lists. What books you should read at the beach? Do people even read books at the beach anymore? How many people are going to bring their Kindle or iPad to the beach? After all, some bully could kick sand on it. But I do believe, whatever your prose delivery system may be, that perhaps you should declare a moratorium on certain books. I'm not suggesting these books be banned, of course. I'm just suggesting that you not read them. Not reading something is easy. America does it all the time. No more books about Tuscany. No books based on funny websites, Flickr photos, Twitter feeds, or blogs. No novels about suburban couples in trouble. No thrillers involving a centuries-old top-secret cabal. No books about young urban women with mixed feelings about shopping. No recovery memoirs. Much as I love them, maybe we should give Scandinavian mysteries a rest. Give Hungary a chance at that market. And enough on slow food already. I don't want to read about that adorable dog you had once, okay? If I need to lose weight, I'll go to my doctor, not a book I picked up at the airport. No books about how to have a baby. Human beings have been performing this activity for thousands of years. We don't need instruction manuals. No more books by surly chefs. Perhaps we could take a break from nasty celebrity biographies, bland celebrity biographies, tell-all celebrity memoirs, or boring tell-nothing celebrity memoirs. No more books about conflicted vampires, please. And perhaps you could admit that Jane Austen and zombies really don't mix. I'm sure your garden is wonderful, but I don't want to read about it. I don't want inspiration, don't want success tips, and I don't want to read about your struggles with dot, dot, dot. Books by and about forensic pathologists? Let's take a break, all right? Ditto with hard-hitting exposés. Nothing against them, but I need to catch up with the ones we have. And let's take a break from books by Fox News personalities, or television personalities in general. What do I recommend? Well, read what you already have. Don't you still have that copy of some doorstopper by Tom Wolfe? Read it, and give it to Goodwill, as God intended. I still have a copy of The Strange and Unreadable Temptation of St. Anthony by Gustave Flaubert that I bought at a secondhand store in the 70s for a quarter. I admit it, I bought it to display prominently in the student union and impress girls. Didn't work. Maybe this summer I'll finally dust it off and tackle it again. Maybe not. After all, it took Flaubert most of his life to write it, so I figure if it takes most of my life to read it, I'm kind of returning the favor. I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the only man who can solve a philosophical problem in 60 seconds.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.